CliffCentral.com.
That's nice. That's very chilled. That's a good way to start the morning, right?
With the now married black coffee.
That's right. He had a wedding over the holidays.
Yeah, this last weekend.
Right. Good for him. Apparently, he was also robbed over the weekend. Not this weekend, the one before. Someone held him at gunpoint and stole a bunch of his stuff. And not great. So I hope all ended well with the wedding and that it was a beautiful affair. Good for him. Black coffee, everybody, with time to go. Well, it's time to get the former mayor of Johannesburg, Parks Tau, in. I was very, very keen to speak to him during the election cycle and hear about all the things that he's done. He's implemented a whole bunch of programs in Joburg, which we continue to feel the benefits of. And, you know, things like Josie at Work and the rest of it. So I want to speak to him this morning and find out what is on his agenda at the moment. So let's bring him in. Let's bring the former mayor of Johannesburg, Mr. Parks Tau, in here. He is currently a councillor. He's in the ANC. So he's in opposition benches in the municipality. And while he was mayor, there were lots of things that happened in Johannesburg, lots of interesting developments. We'll find out all about which ones he's most proud of and just touch base with him. How are you?
Okay,
have a seat here, Mr. Tau. Very, very nice to see you. How are you? Good. Good. Very nice to have you here. And how are you at the moment? Are you not as frantic and frenetic and crazy as you were as mayor, or are you even more busy now?
Well, it's a bit of both, I would say. It's a bit contradictory. If you think about it, I've assumed two additional responsibilities since the elections as president of the South African Local Government Association and its counterpart, the United Cities and Local Governments. So in many ways, I'm hectic from that point of view. But mayor keeps you kind of grounded. It keeps you busy. You have to worry about traffic lights, potholes, and the daily things that mayors worry about.
Well, don't worry about that. That's Herman Mashaba's problem now. Now, I've for a long time sort of watched what you were doing as mayor and even before that. And you really did some amazing stuff for the city of Joburg. I thought that you were a great mayor, and I was kind of sorry to see you go. Having said that, it opens up new opportunities for you to explore other responsibilities. And as part of the Gauteng ANC, as part of the municipality of Johannesburg, and now as a councillor in opposition, there are obviously lots of things you could still do. But while you were mayor, you did some pretty interesting stuff in terms of getting the city working in ways that it wasn't working before, in terms of not just infrastructural stuff, but even programs that really helped a lot of people. Of those programs, you must be proud of how some of them have turned out and continue to work.
Certainly. And I think the first, which is not always visible, is with regards to the financial resilience of the organization, because cities are complex organizations.
Such a complicated thing to run budget-wise, right?
Budget-wise, they are credit rated, so you need to run it as a business. You need to be able to raise money from the debt capital markets. You raise bonds. We created innovations such as the first municipal bond in the country post-apartheid was issued by the city of Johannesburg. The first green bond internationally to be listed on a stock exchange was listed by the city of Johannesburg. And we've been able to look at innovative financing solutions, including discussing with international organizations on how we can create a broad base of financial instruments that not only the city of Johannesburg, but all the cities in Gauteng could leverage from through a pooled financing mechanism.
Let me just stop you for a second, because this is actually one of the reasons that I'm a fan of yours, is because it does come down to leadership. There are much smaller municipalities. There are much smaller sort of, town councils and things all over the country that don't have nearly the complexity of Johannesburg. And you ran it well enough to have a clean bill of health, to have all these accreditations, to be able to manage this enormously complex city, which is the biggest economy in South Africa, is in the city of Johannesburg. You did that so well. What's wrong with all these Smolanyana people who are running these little municipalities? I mean, if you could do it right, then is it down to your unique set of leadership skills? Was it down to your team? How come Krugersdorp can't get it right? How come places like, I don't know, some little free state town that nobody's ever heard of can't do it properly, but you could.
I think there are different and varied factors. I always say I speak on behalf of all the local authorities in the country now. So
yeah, you got to be careful. You can't knock them all.
But I mean, but I think the issue is,
that because you've got credibility.
The issue really is that in a city like Johannesburg, you're able to attract the most appropriate skills. It's always difficult to attract the appropriate skills. You need the appropriate level of engineers, financial people into the organization that you can attract that would help you achieve your vision. And that, I think, augurs well for the larger cities because they are able to compete for the best skills in the country. They generally remunerate even higher than national government for senior government officials, not councillors. Councillors are disadvantaged, but in terms of the administration, you're able to remunerate well. But it's also about almost delineating what the responsibilities of the organization is. And in my mind, it was always about three things when you look at a city like Johannesburg. The first is about you have to run it like a business. You have to take into account that this institution is credit rated, that it trades, it sells water, electricity. It generates revenue through rates and so on. So it's important that you take those into account, that you manage the appropriate levels of credit ratings, that you're able to leverage your balance sheet. So in many ways, you think about it as a business. Mm. The second is you think about it as a service delivery agency. So you balance your responsibilities as a trading and commercial entity with this being a service delivery agency, and how you deploy resources to improve service delivery is always important, but you also deploy resources to maximize your returns. So sometimes how you invest in infrastructure has to reduce losses, improve revenue, and those are some of the considerations in how you deliver services. And lastly, as an agent for transformation, we live in a country that has huge development challenges, a history of segregation, high levels of inequality and unemployment. So it's very important that when you look at a city and government, that you look at the opportunities it gives you for transformation. So I always looked at it as this third leg of the responsibilities about looking at the city as an agent for transformation. And that brings me to your original question about some of the transformation programs that we're running. Programs such as Josie at Work were about the redesign of the way in which we provide municipal services. Because when you look at services, it's not just about getting the service from one point to the next. There are different models of providing the service. And if you look at the state as an instrument of transformation, you can redesign the way in which you provide services in a manner that involves communities and empowers people, creates jobs, and ensures broad-based participation.
So with Josie at Work, what you did was you decentralized certain parts of service delivery, and you brought in smaller partners in different communities who were able to do things like the refuse collections, like implementing some of the infrastructural development, that kind of thing. Is that about right?
That's about right. Which makes a lot of sense.
Then many people are brought in rather than one big company that gets a contract from government.
Certainly. And those people buy in, because then communities buy into the work that's being implemented by the city. It is a co-production model. We learned lessons from a number of co-production models that were successful internationally. And that's how we introduced Josie at Work, because co-production is about ensuring that communities are partners in the delivery of services, that they are not just consumers of services, but are partners in the delivery of services. And therefore, you leverage and take advantage of the skills, capabilities, and interests, and civic capability and interest of the people in the city to ensure broad-based participation. So you kind of use municipal services as a means of creating civic engagement and civic participation whilst you're addressing unemployment, poverty, inequality, and issues of enterprise development that are so critical in the country. And we did this in a number of areas. We introduced, for example, the Innovation Fund that we used Resolution Circle at United the University of Johannesburg as a means of trying to identify ways in which innovators could help us find innovative ways of delivering services and addressing our challenges. And if you think about it, many enterprises internationally are created at the back of innovations that are financed jointly by research agencies and government. So we said to UJ and Resolution Circle, which is an entity of UJ, what we want in our partnership is help us find solutions for our problems as a municipality. We anticipate that the water challenges would be serious, so help us find solutions, but bring in innovators to find innovative solutions. Let us incubate these enterprises so that they are able to help us address the water challenges from a demand.
But Parks, you know that this is very unusual for governments, especially at local government level, who sometimes, you know, you're often in a big organization like the ANC, some of the people who are deployed right at the top at cabinet level and all the rest are the alpha choice list people. And then later on, further on down the list, you do obviously have really good deployments like mayors and so on. But there are a lot of people who, because they're in government and just by virtue of the fact that they're in government, aren't that open to hearing other people's ideas, especially from academics and so on. So they're not even willing to acknowledge very often that they've even got the problem. That's a major move by your municipality when you were mayor to go, well, look, we probably are going to encounter some problems. Let's talk to a couple of people and hear some ideas. That's got to be the first time that that's happened in South Africa for, you know.
Well, not really memory. The first time. I mean, we had a lot of innovation that was happening in Tshwane. We've had innovations happening in Durban and Cape Town. So in many ways, I think the large metros were able to leverage from the opportunities that are created in metropolitan environments. I think what we did as the ANC in Johannesburg is we created a level of continuity in the organization where there wouldn't be a lot of disruption. So I could say you could always bring it down to a lot of experience to ensuring that we don't lose other spheres.
Speaking of losing, do you think that they lost that election just because of Togo Didiza being proposed as the candidate, or do you think it was a lot more complicated?
I think it was a lot more complicated. I think that there were a number of factors that had to do with the candidate selection process, a lot of factors that we have been reflecting on as the ANC about our relationship with communities, about the extent to which, in certain instances, there are matters of probity in governance, about accountability and responsibility that affects the entire ANC and governance in the country, that we've had to reflect on and say we need to improve on this.
I hope you don't think I'm being impertinent, but I really thought it was unfair that hardworking people in Gauteng in particular within the ANC structures had to bear the brunt of what was nationally a complicated situation, in that those people ended up being punished at the polls, at the local government polls, for mistakes that weren't even theirs necessarily, or for a national feeling that wasn't their making. And I felt like there were a lot of good people in the Gauteng ANC, David Makura, yourself, people like Paul Mashatile, people who've worked really hard to make Johannesburg, Gauteng, the province that it is, the cities that Johannesburg and Tshwane are. I felt that, and you don't have to comment on this, but I think it needs saying, and I'm glad that I'm finally sitting face to face with you where I can say it. I felt that it seemed almost like an unfair situation that you guys bore the brunt of national politics when at the coalface, and this is why Selga is so important, we'll talk about that in a moment. At the coalface of government, it's about service delivery. And the municipalities and the local government levels are the ones that have to bear the brunt of that. When the national people carry on doing their thing, making speeches, going around the country, campaigning, being in parliament, all those things that are a lot more nebulous to ordinary citizens. To us, the local government is the place where we interact the most.
You know, the Secretary General of the African version of SALGA, United Cities and Local Governments in Africa, always makes the example or analogy that when there's a disaster, general ministers come, he says in helicopters, come, look at the problem, says, well, there's a problem, something needs to be done, takes the helicopter and leaves. The mayor has to live with the problem on a daily basis.
And it happens all over the world.
It happens all over the world.
This happened in New Orleans with the floods that they had there. We know it happens in cities in every part of the world.
It happens all over the world, but I took a pragmatic view about the elections, post the elections, of course, reflecting on the outcomes of the elections. And I said, look, isn't it that maybe when we did lose Johannesburg, we had to reflect as an organization to say, well, you know, it's not always about whether the institution is performing, whether the programs that you're implementing are dealing with the issues. It's always about, in certain instances, how people perceive governance overall and the reality that we function in a unitary environment. And it literally forced us as the ANC to reflect, to go back. And I think if you listen to the president over the weekend, he kind of indicated that the National Executive Committee has also reflected on these issues and reflected to say, look, there are things we need to change. There are things we need to do better. And if we don't do better, the electorate is not going to take kindly to it.
I didn't listen to the president because I'm tired of him. I would listen to people like you. I would listen to David Makura. I would listen to Paul Mashatila. I would listen to people who seem to me to be interested in delivering to the people of this country. And again, I don't expect your comment on this, but it seems to me like you're saying the right things, which I know it's your job to do in many situations. And in this one, I applaud you for the job that you have done already. You've got the credentials. You don't have anything to prove. It seems to me ridiculous that someone like you should have had to take up other jobs when you were so good at doing the job that you had before. That's all. So, you know, take it as a compliment and let's move on.
Thank you much. Appreciate it.
So you're born in Orlando West. So you're a born and bred Johannesburg Soweto boy. How the hell did you get into politics in the first place? How did this journey happen for you?
Well, it started at school as a student activist. I joined the Congress of South African Students, and after it was banned, the Soweto Student Congress, and it became an evolution. I became an activist. I later became president of the Soweto Youth Congress, and later, when the ANC was unbanned, the convener of the ANC Youth League in Soweto. And it's been that sort of evolution in struggle. So being in political office, so to say, came about as part of the evolution to say, now that South Africa is democratic, who then assumes the responsibilities? And we found ourselves at a very early age being thrust into the responsibility of being councillors. I served in the Southern Metro Local Council, in the first instance responsible for urban development, and later responsible for the environment and other portfolios, and it evolved. So it was really an evolution starting from the struggle days.
But I don't want to breeze over the struggle days, because you were detained during some of those states of emergency, and that couldn't have been an easy time for you or your family. I mean, they must have been worried about you. There must have been a lot of people, even though you had support, even though you had your comrades with you all the time. You know, and you didn't go to Robben Island, but you were detained. And this is a scary thing for a young activist to actually go through. You put in some hard hours and you took some serious risks.
Yes, and it was difficult for my parents, for my family. I mean, you know, when I go back to those years and I look at my kids and I say, but 15 years, I mean, this is a very young age to be in detention.
Yeah.
You can't even imagine them going into a prison cell at 15 years. For the family, it was very difficult. It was very difficult for them to accept that I had chosen to be in struggle, particularly because you engaged in student struggles in a school that's not affected by Bantu education necessarily. Because we were in Pace Commercial College in Soweto. It was a private college in Soweto. It was essentially an IEP examination college. So it wasn't necessarily affected by the daily struggles of education. And mobilizing that environment was also difficult. I still meet former schoolmates that say, but why did you guys try and lead us into the struggle thing? Because we were not affected by those things. But we always said, look, the struggles of our peers and colleagues around us every day are our struggles. And when we leave school, the struggles in our communities are our own struggles. So we can't run away from the struggles. We're part of the struggles and we need to engage with them.
It couldn't have always been easy, because now people look at it and they go, well, that was the path to take. That was the noble path, the one that you did choose. But, I mean, your parents must have, and your friends, these ones who you speak of, with very different reasons, must have said to you on regular occasions, why are you bothering? You know, life's not so bad for you in particular. Why do you have to take on the mantle of a whole lot of other people suffering and struggling? And even with lots of people I've spoken to and interviewed here about their time during the struggle, there were a lot of, you know, the previous generation who said, don't cause trouble. Rather, let's just find our way through this. Let's just get a good education, try to find a good job. You know, it wasn't always that the struggle was the best way for people to go. And only after 1994 did people start to tell a lot of those stories, because it was painful.
It was. I mean, my parents were, excuse me, finding it very difficult to come to terms with the decisions that I'd made. At that point, you're a teenager, but you're making very difficult decisions. You're participating in complex struggles and participating in community struggles. In fact, they had arranged for me to go and study abroad at some point, and I said, but I can't. I can't leave. I'm part of the leadership collective of the students of Soweto. I just can't pack up and go, and education is facing a crisis in Soweto and in the rest of the country. I'm part of the Soweto Student Congress because COSAS was banned then, so I'm not going to leave. Thinking about it, I mean, if I look at my kids now and they tell me, no, I'm not going to go to school because...
You'd be furious.
So I can imagine how my parents felt at the time. But they came around, and I think after the detentions and those sort of things, they kind of accepted that this is the route he has chosen, and they started supporting
Get to see you become mayor of Johannesburg?
My dad didn't, unfortunately, but my mother is still alive, so she was there. In fact, in my inaugural speech, I did say, you know, this is the first public statement I make in front of my mother. So it was the most difficult statement to make, because I can remember that the first thing they asked me when they heard that I'm a student activist was, but you don't even have a voice to speak for yourself at home. How do you speak on behalf of
But I mean, they must, even in the early parts of this whole struggle, when your father must have seen that there was, that you were doing something that was really bigger and better than an ordinary job, he must have been pleased at some point in the process.
He certainly was. My mother did say that it's unfortunate that he didn't live to see me leading the city of Johannesburg. It I think, was something that he would have been very proud of, particularly because he always knew that it was about commitment. It was about trying to contribute towards the betterment of society, the betterment of humanity, and confronting the difficulties that we face as communities and as a people. And I think seeing it in terms of its translation into higher office was always going to be something that he would have been proud of.
Now, it's interesting to me. I mean, like a lot of people in politics, their kids don't want to go into politics. There are very few of the members of cabinet whose kids are actively engaged in political. Most of them go into business, right? Do you think that they see how hard it is? Because it is tough being in politics. You never really know what could happen. You are at the whim of the electorate most often, sometimes of your political superiors. It's not like having a business of your own or a job of your own or some kind of security. There's none of that in politics. Do you think that's why so few of the kids of politicians end up being politicians themselves?
It's also because it's difficult for the family. We're never really around. So they accept the reality that, in fact, I've had to live with parents that have never really been around, because he has all these responsibilities that he places ahead of everything else, and doesn't always create the time that is necessary for family. So I think that sometimes they look at those things and the sort of burden that comes with the responsibility and say, well, this is not for me. I have a son, he's he's still a member of the youth league, but he says to me, but dad, you know, he's a member of the youth league, but he's into hip hop. And he says, so I say, no, but this thing of yours, he says, no, I'm from a generation where you can make a living from hip hop and skateboarding. So don't try and channel me into your direction. I identify with you and your politics. But
your son had a very public, he went public with the fact that he had a drug problem at one stage. He's over that now, and he's obviously, you know, in a good space.
He is in a good space, which is quite fortunate, because I think in many instances we don't get our children to get out of those environments. And it was a difficult period for all of us, for the entire family. And as parents, you always kind of reflect on as to whether am I responsible for this? Is this because I wasn't there?
Exactly. Did you feel this way because you had so many overwhelming responsibilities? Did you kind of look to your son and go, I failed you in some way? I mean, most parents blame themselves.
I think you do, and I did. I did. I kind of looked at myself and said, but I wasn't always the father that's there to deal with the daily issues, but also to observe certain developments in the family and say, you know, something's going wrong here. I need to do something about it. And even as it happens, even when you intervene, you kind of literally outsource it. You try and find a psychologist to help him. Whilst you're doing other things, you're trying to get somebody to help him, but you're not there to provide the basic support structure that's there, particularly because when you look at boys, they always want a father figure of some sort. So you can't always outsource it to the mother and say, well, you know, try and manage these problems.
But when you were mayor, you couldn't switch your phone off?
No, you couldn't.
So you would be receiving calls at 3 a.m, there's some emergency, because any emergency in the city becomes your problem, right?
It is. And I always said my phone is a call center, because it rings all the time. I get messages all the time. And you have to engage with them. In certain instances, people do require direct response. And in certain instances, there are emergencies that require your attention, and you have to be able to respond and deal with those emergencies. In certain instances, when you do get the message, you can send to other colleagues to deal with. But there are those that you need to respond to directly yourself.
Did you ever have those annoying situations where someone who knew you, let's say someone who was an old school friend, or someone who had your number because maybe you'd had dealings before in the party or in the youth league or anything else, and they said, they called you at like 12 o'clock at night, and Parks, my lights are out, or my road has a pothole, and they think because they know you or because they had access to you that you're going to come around with a team of people and in a truck and fix it just because they call you directly. Did you ever have that situation?
Certainly you do.
So how do you respond politely to those people to remind them that there's a process?
Sometimes it's on a Saturday night. So,
oh man!
So you can imagine the state they are in when they're engaging in this discussion.
Let me show you. I'll just call the mayor and have this fixed. Showing off to their friends, drunk at a party. Yeah. It's a hell of a thing to be a mayor. And you mentioned earlier, whenever anything goes wrong, then that's your first port of call. Do you have any sympathy for the incoming mayors, particularly because their parties haven't really, with the exception of Cape Town, run municipalities, especially not of the size of Johannesburg? Does Herman Mashaba, do you and he have good conversations, or are you mostly completely unsympathetic to his problems since you've been there already?
Well, you know, I think that we have to have good conversations in the interests of the people of Johannesburg to share experiences. I think that the first few months were a bit too antagonistic. I found that when he came in, it was more about bashing us, and we kind of pulled back and said, well, if this guy is going to bash us,
then we're not going to help.
You know what?
Yeah. Why would you?
You can't have a telephone call with somebody that every time you look at him is kind of saying, well, you know, these guys couldn't hand out title deeds when we applied for the title deeds and he just arrived and distributed. But So you kind of took that view. But And I did say to some of the colleagues in the city of Johannesburg, it would be unfortunate if the leadership of the city of Johannesburg doesn't leverage from the fact that I'm world president of local governments and sure. I'm responsible for ensuring access to resources for local authorities from international agencies, and Johannesburg must leverage from it. Johannesburg must take advantage of the fact that one of its own serves in this position. And through this position, I interact with the United Nations. I'm having a meeting with the new United Nations Secretary General this month. We're waiting for confirmation of the date to discuss areas of collaboration and cooperation. I'm meeting with the Dutch version of local government associations that's very supportive to African local governments also this month. And similarly, I'm meeting with the EU to talk about how they can support local authorities. So if Joburg sits back and says, we're not going to talk to this guy, it would be quite unfortunate. So for me, it's very important that Joburg and all South African cities are able to leverage. Otherwise, the benefit of Africa and South Africa holding this position doesn't get to the people that I think deserve it.
Being world president of local governments is an incredible role, and in some ways, you know, it's more important. It gives you access in some ways to, you know, talking to mayors of cities like Beijing and Los Angeles and some of these places which are enormous and have challenges all of their own. But it's also obviously a way for us to, it's quite prestigious that South Africa is at the top of that organization, that you represent us there. I'm curious about how much of a free hand you think local government people should have. And I'm asking in the context of what Solim Simanga did the other day, which a lot of people are criticizing, rightly or wrongly, when he met with the mayor of Taipei, I think it was, and the government there. I don't know what the purpose of it was. Perhaps it was purely just, you know, causing political trouble by talking to people who are not recognized as being the real Chinese. They got huge amounts of heat. He got taken down a couple of pegs by the ANC in Parliament, by the Durko, for interfering in our international relations. But how good can your relations be with other mayors on the basis that you don't need to always check in with Durko? What if you're just sharing information about, I don't know, highways and water and sanitation and that kind of thing? Is there any explanation that makes Solim Simanga look like he wasn't just troublemaking?
Well, and we do share information with a whole range of municipalities and best practices internationally. I think that taking the initiative on its own is not the wrong thing. But when Durko advises that you should take into account that there are international protocols that Durko would be privy to that they don't always share with the local authorities, for whatever reason, maybe because we're not always involved in that space. So you should take guidance from Durko, because ultimately international relations policy starts with domestic interest. So there's South African domestic interest that we all need to protect. So when Durko says, please don't do something like this, you have to take into account that there are domestic interests. And Durko always advises that before you make an international trip, please make sure that you touch base so that we can be able to provide necessary support, so that we can be able to give you the advice, but so that we can also ensure that our embassy on the other side is able to give you briefings. Because remember, when you meet with a mayor in Taipei or wherever, they are also serving their national interests. They didn't invite him because they're not serving Taiwanese interests. Sure. They are serving Taiwanese interests.
Absolutely.
So ultimately, when you go there, you also need to serve South African interests. And that, I think, is always important to take into account.
The job of local government is very complicated. It involves lots and lots of different people at different levels in civil society, in business, in government, in all of those places. What I'm curious about is, a lot of people talk about how great Cape Town is all the time, and it irritates me, because not that Cape Town isn't fantastic, but Johannesburg's where it's at. Johannesburg is the economic heart and soul of South Africa. It's a much more integrated and diverse city in many ways. I love it. I'm very attached to the fact that I come from Joburg, just because we don't have beautiful mountains and that kind of thing, and we're flat and we have gold mine dumps and that kind of thing. Doesn't mean that we're not, that somehow Cape Town is the sexy sibling and we're the ugly, deformed sibling who just has the money. Do you sometimes have to have these discussions with people to remind them of what a prize Joburg really is? Even though you're not mayor anymore, you care about this city.
I'm very passionate about Johannesburg. So I sometimes do say to people, look, Johannesburg is the most cosmopolitan city on the African continent. It's the city that's recognized as the economic powerhouse, not just of South Africa and Southern Africa, but of the African continent. It attracts business. It attracts innovative people. It's hardworking people. It's like when you go to other parts of the world, cities have different responsibilities. I always took a view, even when I was mayor of the city of Johannesburg, that, look, it's not for me to bash any other city. When I am on international platforms, it's always important that I also promote other South African cities.
I'm not going to let us bash Cape Town. I'd love us to bash Cape Town, but let's leave it for now. I'm asking you to boast about Joburg, because when you're in the seat of mayor, you get to see the good and the bad. But there's a huge amount of good in this place. There's so much that we can be proud of. There's so many unique things, some of them you've already mentioned, about Johannesburg that make it such an interesting place.
Certainly. And I think that the sort of energy that you have in the city of Johannesburg, the buzz, the innovation, the its ability to confront complex problems, not just in government, but also in business, in other sections of society, is something that I think is something that people study all over the world, and they look at and they say, actually, Johannesburg is a city that's able to integrate and deal with the complex issues. It's a city that's able to confront the issues that it has to deal with. But also, if you look at our universities and the issues they are dealing with, they are dealing with issues about finding solutions for our cities, for our economy. When I spoke about Resolution Circle in the University of Johannesburg, it's an innovation that's trying to ensure that we're able to tap into the intellectual capital in the university to grow the local economy. When you look at the work that we did with Verts with regard to ICT and the ICT hub that we established there, and the partnerships that we're able to develop with business across the board to deal with the problems, I think that you can say that there's always an energy to try and find solutions. It's entrepreneurial, if I may use the word.
Absolutely.
It's entrepreneurial.
Yeah. But that's that out-of-the-box thinking. And you also launched Vulindlela Jozi, which is that was under you, right? The 150 million youth program. How did that go?
Vulindlela Jozi was a very exciting program because, excuse me, if you think about it, then we've just come out of the matric results situation. Learners are registering for university. Most of them are not going to gain access into university education. Most of them would not be able to gain access into jobs. So Vulindlela Jozi was an innovation that said, how do we partner with the private sector and other public sector agencies to ensure that we can break down barriers to entry into the economy for these young people? Yeah, we partnered with Harambe, which is a youth development accelerator that have done exciting work in this regard. And they brought with them about 250 companies that would be able to create access for these young people into opportunities. We created platforms such as the Matric Rewrite Program, where we partnered with UJ and the Gauteng Department of Education, so that those matriculants that haven't been able to pass their matric or at least not reach the marks that enable them to gain access to better opportunities are able to go into a rewrite program on an online facilitated learning program. We created the massive open online varsity program, which was the introduction of open online varsity into South Africa and partnerships with international organizations, where we were creating access to online university education free of charge because young people would not have access to opportunity. It was at its beginning stages. It started with programs related to software development, and the idea was to develop it. And we'd already identified partners to create vocational learning and other university programs into the MOVE program, and would utilize city libraries as the platform, would have facilitators, because we took lessons from the MOOC program, Massive Open Online Colleges in the US. But part of the lessons that we took from there is that it's only the advantage that can take full advantage of free online education, because they have access to the necessary internet resources. So what we did was to introduce facilitators into the program, use our libraries as centers to facilitate the learning and to create collective learning programs for the learners. And it was already beginning to yield results. In fact, one of the learners has gone to the US to complete the program and be able to become a worldwide facilitator in these sort of initiatives. And we were on the verge of signing an agreement with one of the US colleges on creating vocational learning. So you would have your library.
Did Herman Mashaba come in and grab that and pretend it was his work?
Unfortunately, he decided it's a vanity project that is canceling.
Oh, really?
So we're trying to look at ways, because I still have to remember that I'm still the, as I said, the chairperson of the ANC and leader of the opposition in Johannesburg. So we're saying there's a program. If the city leadership dumps it, then we believe in it. We have to find alternative ways of implementing it. So we're trying to look at the alternative partners to see if we can continue the programs. But I do think that if you think about it, the biggest problem we have in the country is access to education, because through education, yeah, through skills development, you can overcome the bulk of your problems. And if we can use innovative ways of ensuring access to education, I think we should always do that.
No, absolutely. Can I bring us back to more practical things? I remember while you were mayor, there was a couple of weeks where we had our rubbish bins outside here. Now, I want to know how it works from your point of view. So we had these things outside here. They're getting, you remember, Mubs, they're getting smellier and smellier and fuller and fuller. And
well, we had rats move in because, you know, the rubbish attracted bigger families of rats. Mm.
So when these things start becoming a problem, you obviously are informed early on. You're sitting in your office or you're on the go, you're doing stuff. So it must be, and you mentioned earlier, complex problems in Johannesburg and how to solve them. So you've got in this situation a very complicated issue, because you've got an agency that's meant to be responsible for this, that work for you. Then you've, and they've got their own leadership, that agency. Then you've got unions, and the unions are fighting for their workers to get more money out of you. But you can't keep spending more and more money on the workers if you don't have the budget to do so. So there are pressures on you from both sides, pressures from the workers, from the unions on the one side, from the agency on the other that is tasked with doing something like refuse removal. Yeah. And then you're getting the public who are increasingly getting annoyed that their rubbish isn't being collected and all of the stuff. So it's a deeply practical problem on one hand, but on the other hand, it's a nightmare to try and balance this equation. How do you begin to do this? Do you get everyone into a room? How does it work?
Well, firstly, you have to allow management to engage with the trade union so that you don't usurp the responsibilities of management, but get the appropriate reports and provide the guidance about what needs to be done. Secondly, you need to identify what the problem is. And in certain instances, the problems could have been subjective. In this instance, we had problems that are both objective and subjective. And when I say subjective, the unions were demanding that we remove the MD, and we were saying, but you need to make your allegations to enable us to investigate, to enable us to arrive at an objectively decided conclusion on this matter. You can't make allegations and we simply dismiss, because the day that happens, it means any allegation that's made, somebody should be dismissed.
Yeah.
And the public says, but why don't you accede to the union's demands? But what that means is that actually the union could tomorrow demand that somebody else be dismissed, and you'd have to make a similar decision. So we say, if you have allegations, give us the allegations so that we process them. Now we're going through that process. So when I say subjective, it is those issues where we think allow the process to reach its logical conclusion. If we've agreed and we've said the allegations, allow the investigation to conclude, and then we can come to
And is everybody reasonable in this, or are people shouting and screaming? I mean, what's it like in the room?
No, there's a lot of shouting and screaming. The unions can be very, very difficult. The unions sometimes make demands. We had just turned around to pick it up because when we came into office in the current in the previous administration, rather, we came into a situation where two of the entities of the city of Johannesburg were in the red, the Johannesburg Roads Agency and Pick It Up. And the immediate mandate to both of them was, you have to turn your situation around. We're not going to bail you out all the time. You know, South Africans complain about government bailing out agencies all the time.
Yeah.
So one of the things, and it wasn't because people complained, but we looked at the work they'd been doing. Remember, I was the MMC Finance, so I knew what their financial position was and what the mistakes they'd been making were. So we said to them, get yourself out of the problem. You're not going to recruit yourself into solutions. You're not going to manage your finances in a manner that's not responsible. And we gave them a 3-year period in which to resolve those problems. And they made difficult decisions in that period, which angered the unions in certain instances as the belt was tightening. And the unions were demanding that, for example, in Pick It Up, that we absorb people that were in private contracting companies or arrangements into the city of Johannesburg. And we said, but that arrangement is unfair because these are contracted services. You can't bring them into the organization. And we also found that even when we acceded to that demand, there were salary disparities between the people that were coming from outside and the people internally.
Right.
And they wanted the problems to be resolved immediately. And we said, but you can't resolve that problem immediately. You need to take a medium to long-term view about salary parity, because depending on what you do to your salary budget, it impacts on what you do with regards to services. It impacts on how you can raise loans, in the debt capital markets. So we look at ratios such as the salary to operating budget ratio. It was under pressure.
Yeah, you don't want to create sheltered employment for a whole bunch of people.
Exactly. Oh. So, but the union demands, it says we need parity now. And we took a view that this is an unreasonable demand, and they decided to, well, go on strike, and we interdicted the strike. We won in the interdict because we said to management when they went on strike, interdict. And we got the interdict in favor of the city and Pick It Up, and they decided to strike anyway. Now, that's a very difficult situation to manage when people are on an illegal strike. And the first thing that the public says is, why don't you talk to them? Said, no, we need to take action against people that are.
Well, I remember the public was at a certain point, they were just saying, well, just fire them, which you also can't do.
It's not as easy as that, because in fact, if you fire all of them, you might get a sympathy strike from the rest of the organization. You might even get a national sympathy strike. So it's not as easy as just fire them. You need to sit there and say, how do I balance the issues? You know that if because remember, unions protect each other, they protect the environment, that's their responsibility.
But you see, the reason I wanted you to try and explain the situation from the inside is because when we look at government, we very often see national government, we see people in blue light brigades, we see people there at the opening of parliament, we hear them in speeches, and you don't see the hard, ugly, nasty negotiations that have to go on in these rooms where people are shouting and screaming at each other. And that's the stuff that, especially in local government, which brings me to your role in SELGA, makes it a very hands-on business. And politics at that level is mean. It requires enormous patience. It requires a dedication to not only serving the people and hopefully delivering for those people, but it's unglamorous. There's nothing fun about that kind of politics. It really is for people who consider themselves representatives of the people, servants of the people.
You know, in Latin America, they call local government community government.
Mm.
Because literally, I mean, talking about the Pick It Up strike, I got a call at 11 o'clock at night, and a truck driver during the strike had been shot at. And there's no time to say, well, where is JMPD? So I took the car, drove out, went to the scene, and kind of saw what's the problem. when the police arrived, I said, what are you doing here? Because you're not supposed to be
here.
It's
dangerous, right?
It's dangerous. Yeah. You're supposed to have protection with you when you get into this sort of environment.
It's like when that bridge collapsed at Grayston, I saw you walking around there without your hard hat. You arrived before almost anybody else. I thought, what this? We don't need you to get killed by some falling debris.
But the reality is you almost get the sense that I need to respond immediately. And some of the times it's about the immediate answers you provide to the problems that you confront, that you don't have the privilege of waiting for tomorrow morning. You kind of have to go on the scene now and ensure that things are able to happen immediately. So, as you say, it's not glamorous. It's not something that many say, well, I wouldn't want to leave other levels of government to go and serve in local government, because you're dealing with the troubles every day. You have to confront them every single day, and they are direct, because when somebody's lights are off, you can't direct them to somewhere else. When they call you, you have to kind of find a solution to the problem.
And they expect you to find it immediately.
Yeah, or to at least have an answer.
And this is why I draw a lot of parallels between Herman Mashaba and Donald Trump, for good or for bad. But I look at these people, they're both very successful businessmen who lived very happy lives, they had lots of money. Why would they even want to go into a horrible job like having to solve electricity and water and sanitation? It's not... It's the most difficult, and you put yourself in the most vulnerable position as a politician at that level. So when you talk at Salga, when you hear other people's problems, what are the biggest frustrations and challenges that people in local government have to deal with, and how can ordinary people in this country contribute to better local government? Because it's not just the responsibility of the leaders.
Well, I think first is to understand local government. I think that we have to make a greater effort to understand how our local authorities work. That it's not just a transactional relationship. I'm not just in the business of buying water and electricity from these guys and paying for the collection of the bins. There are the regulations that govern the work that they do. I always say to people, government is a creature of statutes. Literally, it's a creature of statutes. So literally everything you do, there's a law that governs what you do. So they have to contend with those things. So I think that we have a greater responsibility to understand the responsibility and duties of our local authorities and how they function. Our local authorities face difficult situations, particularly the smaller local authorities. We're dealing now with the situation of Eskom cutting off local authorities that are in arrears. In certain instances, because of their revenue base, they literally live from hand to mouth. They literally, when they get the resources, have to pay salaries, have to do all sorts of things. And when you say salaries, people always think, but it's fair checks. But reality is, somebody has to be in the office to administer the environment of the municipality. You do expect that when the road needs to be fixed, somebody would be there, and that revenue doesn't come from anywhere else except from the local authority itself. And some of the discussions that we're having with national government now is about the review of the fiscal regime in the country, so that we can ensure that municipalities are more financially sustainable and resilient.
Is it your opinion that they don't get enough of the national share of budget?
It certainly is. We've been arguing that local authorities generally get about 9% of the national budget, and then the formula then distributes it amongst the local authorities.
They surely should get more. That's again at the coalface. That's where delivery happens.
That's our contention.
It makes no sense.
So we certainly will continue to argue for that. We'll also argue for a review of the tax regime in the country, so that a greater proportion of taxation can go to local authorities. And when we say that, people think we actually want to levy more tax. No, we're not saying that. We're saying within the tax envelope, a greater proportion of the tax envelope should go to local authorities to ensure more equitable access, but also
aren't we also becoming an increasingly urbanized country? And as a result of that, most of the concentration of where the government needs to be is in urban centers. So in municipalities, in towns, this is where most of that money needs to be spent so that we can keep up with the influx of population.
Certainly. And this we're arguing both at national level, but also internationally. Because even international financing instruments are directed at national governments. Grants are going to national governments and to NGOs, and not enough grants are going to local authorities. And that's the argument we've been making at the United Nations to say, well, no, the system needs to change so that more grants are able to be directed to local authorities. In fact, we were the first in Johannesburg to get a grant from the Global Environment Facility to implement the Corridors of Freedom Initiative. And we went out of our way to convince UN Habitat, to convince Global Environment Facility and the World Bank that, in fact, local authorities are deserving of these resources. Johannesburg was a pilot case. I think it's important that the city is continuing with the implementation of the Corridors of Freedom, because there are international resources that have gone into it. And if we don't get it right here, we make it not work for the local authorities, because this is a pilot initiative where grants are going directly to local authorities. But you manage this understanding that you need to respect the sovereignty of national governments.
Sure.
So you don't want grants to come in a manner that undermines the sovereignty of governments. So, and that's the checks and balances that we have to work through. But this other responsibility now, it's my duty to now argue about how these things are going to happen.
Well, you know what? I'm not so worried anymore that you're not mayor of Joburg. You've got more important stuff to do. So I'll take the whole thing back now after listening to you on that. Because this is very important. I mean, if local government can get a larger share of the total amount of tax, there's so much that can be practically done within those environments that will improve people's lives, which is the point of government, is that you can improve people's lives, especially in a country like ours where there's such disparity. And you can't have, in a city like Joburg, people who live in 40 million rand houses and then people who live in shacks without sanitation or water.
Certainly. And I think that over the next few years, our local authorities, particularly in South Africa, are going to face more complex challenges. If you think about it, because of load shedding, a lot of people are getting off the grid. And remember, electricity is a revenue stream for municipalities. Mm. Joburg generated in excess of 3 billion rands in surpluses from electricity and cross-subsidized other services. So if those who can afford get off the grid,
then there's going to be no revenue.
Then there's no revenue. You can't finance the city. So you're also talking about how do we transition into new technologies, and how does the law begin to appreciate that the tax systems must adapt to the reality that technologies are evolving.
And obviously there's all this emphasis also on green and making the cities green and greening the cities, you know, energy that is sustainable, all that kind of thing. But those are luxuries sometimes in an environment like ours. They're important. They need to be prioritized in some ways. But really, when some people have no electricity at all, you know, turning Sandton into an eco-friendly green zone isn't the most important thing. Or am I wrong?
It depends on how you design it. So we took a view in Johannesburg that how you design it should maintain the long-term sustainability of the city. So you introduce microgrids. Interestingly, we introduced the first microgrid in Tembelihle, where you're generating solar electricity, but it's not solar to the household. It's solar into the grid. So you on-sell the solar, which is stored in a battery, into the household. So you're able to maintain long-term sustainability for the municipality whilst you're addressing the green agenda. So it's about how you design the services. And that's why we spoke about
bicycle lanes, not so important, right? Are they important?
Very, very, very important.
Are they?
Very, very important. You know,
Mabali and I don't like cyclists. We're not big fans of cyclists.
Well, I'm a cyclist, but that's not the reason we introduced bicycle
lanes. And
that lanes.
Stupid 94.7. Can we cancel that? I wish you were still mayor just so we could cancel that stupid fucking race. I hate that thing, man. Yeah. I mean, that was just a terrible thing.
Well, you know, when you look at bicycles, if you study urban mobility systems on a serious note, though, the bicycle is the most equitable way of accessing a city. And London proved it yesterday.
Yeah, they had this massive problem with the whole metro shut down, right?
When the system shut down, the bicycle was the most accessible form of transport. It's environmentally friendly. It's the most energy efficient. You actually use your own energy. So how much more equity do you
need?
That's
why Mabali and I don't like it.
Well, we're just lazy.
Listen. So,
but when we introduced the bicycle lanes, it was with thinking about the future. If your city is going to congest, and we know Johannesburg is congesting, particularly areas such as Sandton, the levels of congestion are increasing at a very fast pace. If you look at the number of buildings coming up in Sandton right now, and you think about mobility in Sandton, you have to find solutions for everybody.
Is it true that the Sandton sanitation situation is very dangerous and precarious, that there's too many people, there's too much in the sewage systems? Is that true?
No, I think the sewage system can accommodate. One of the things about
we don't want exploding human shit all over the place. You know, we can't have that.
No, one of the things that happens in municipalities is before any development application is approved, the service departments have to indicate whether they can accommodate it. There was a lull in some period in terms of investing adequately in sewerage and other services in an area such as Sandton, yeah. But there's been a lot of investment to ensure that you can address the sewerage and roads needs of Sandton.
Right.
But the grid in Sandton is such that it's going to be difficult to survive if you actually are going to
Your problem anymore. Let Herman figure this one out. Listen, it's a great pleasure to have you here, Parksdale. We really are pleased. You've been on my agenda for the longest time to sit and talk to. I knew you'd be a fascinating man to interact with. And please keep doing the good work that you're doing at Selga and as World President of Local Governments. We need, obviously, to keep the attention on this very important arm of how we get the services that we need from our governments.
Thank you very much. I much appreciate it.
Thank you. What a pleasure to have you here. Parksdale, everybody. We're going to wrap it up with the news. Here's what you need to know this morning so you can start your day. The great Kim Kardashian jewel heist is feared to have been an inside job, with some of the 17 rounded up suspects being in her employ, Mubs. Can you believe that? That's terrible. Police are still trying to get a statement from Ryan Seacrest as to what really happened, but Seacrest insists that everyone will have to wait until the new season of Keeping Up with the Kardashians to get the full story. Ratings, ratings, ratings. Donald Trump continues to try and book entertainment for his presidential inauguration. With numerous high-profile performing artists already opting out of the event, Trump is getting desperate. This week, he allegedly approached the Spice Girls. Posh, Baby, and Sporty are all in, but Mel B is still preoccupied with trying to get alimony out of Eddie Murphy, so it's unlikely to happen. And finally, FIFA celebrated their inaugural The Best Awards last night, which replaces the Ballon d'Or Awards. Apart from the usual player, team, and coaching awards, FIFA now celebrates the best in annual money laundering, sponsorship markups, stadium profiteering, and third world shakedowns. Yep, those are the new categories. Make sure you don't miss any of it. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Have an excellent day in the company at cliffcentral.com. Thank you to Parksdale, and thank you to you. Cliffcentral.com.